Yesterday, I heard that another somewhat well-known Christian, at least well-known in some circles, had walked away from the faith. Another in a sort of another link in sort of a chain of apostasy over the last few years. And I'm not so sure that we're seeing more of this in the last several years, or if it's just the ubiquitous nature and immediate nature of media and social media these days that brings these things really to our attention all the more than they used to. But as always, when I hear of these things, I was again yesterday very saddened. And of course, I wondered how and why. But there were signs there all along the way. But again, as I always do, I hope we would all do. I hope I would always do, took it as a sobering warning. These things do provide the occasion for self-examination because, of course, no one gets there overnight. But such news is always troubling. Well, the disciples had similarly heard some troubling news, right? They had not only heard that Jesus was going away, but they had heard about those among their own number who would fall away. One would betray the Lord. Another would deny him. And perhaps at this juncture, not being able to discern that these things are separate, when Jesus says to Peter that you will deny me. This is troubling news. Peter, tonight you will deny me before the rooster crows. To his disciples, I'm going away, and just like I told the Jews, where I'm going, you cannot come. One of you will betray me. Troubling, troubling news. And an accurate consideration of this context, we open up with verse 1 of chapter 14, and this is a familiar verse. Let not your hearts be troubled. And Jesus speaks of how he's going to prepare a place, and that he is the way and the truth and the life. And all of this is wonderful news, but these words come in the context of a great heaviness. And if we consider the context, we will be impressed upon by the heaviness of the moment and perhaps even the tension in the room as they're still perhaps looking at one another, wondering who it is who is going to betray the Lord. And now hearing that Peter himself will deny Jesus. These are troubled times. These are troubled disciples. But in the midst of their trouble and in the midst of their questions, Jesus offers and extends his comfort. He extends to them his peace, his promise, his direction. And it's really, in summary form, what I want us to see from this text this morning, that in the midst of our troubles and questions, Jesus is there to provide comfort and answers. In the midst of our troubles and questions, Jesus is there to provide comfort and answers. I want to look at these verses with reference to the two disciples who are mentioned here. So in verses 1 to 7, we'll consider Thomas, although Thomas actually doesn't speak until verse 5. We'll kind of introduce the text, what Jesus is saying here in the first four verses, but we'll look at Thomas mainly here as a way of dividing the text. Verses 1 to 7, we'll see it in light of Thomas and what he asks. And then in verses 8 to 11, we'll consider the question, the request from Philip, show us the Father. And then we'll leave verses 12 to 14 for next week, and we'll focus there on those verses, Lord willing, on prayer and its place asking in the means of grace. So Thomas, in verses 1 to 7, Jesus' words in verse 1, again, as we've said there, for troubled souls, let not your hearts be troubled. He wouldn't have said that to them if their hearts were not indeed troubled. The word trouble is to stir up, like stirring up waters, the stirring of waters. It's used back in John chapter 5 at the pool of Bethesda. You remember the man who was the invalid there for 38 years and the stirring of the waters of the pool. It's also a word that Jesus has used in reference to himself. In chapter 12, verse 27, as he spoke of his impending death, knowing his hour had come, he said, "Now is my soul troubled." But then John tells us in chapter 13, verse 21, as Jesus discloses to his disciples that one of them will betray him, that he was troubled in his soul. So the same trouble that Jesus has experienced, now the disciples are experiencing. Jesus has been troubled. Now the disciples are themselves troubled at this news that Jesus has dropped on them. The announcement of his departure, the betrayal. Some of them will prove untrue and unfaithful. And you know, if there ever were a time when self-focus were permissible, you would think this would be that time with what Jesus has coming before him. Self-focus and self-absorption here. But no, I like the way Sinclair Ferguson puts it. He, Jesus, has the weight of the world on his shoulders. And yet, where is his focus? It's not on himself, but it's on his disciples, on helping them, comforting them, ministering to them. Let not your hearts be troubled. He really does care for them. And it's not just the external matters, but he's reaching deep within now. It's not just you're going to be okay, you're going to have food and shelter and clothing. No, but he reaches within. Let not your hearts be troubled. He is calming. He's calmed the storm, but now he is reaching within to calm the storm of the tempest within them. He really does care for them. This is true of all his disciples. This is true of you. And he really does care. Let not your hearts be troubled. And so he provides. He comes alongside. He reaches in. He provides them with his assurance. Now verses 1 and 2 you may have picked up as we read in the ESV. Some of you are reading that or hearing that perhaps. Maybe even know this, have this committed to memory. From other translations, it sounds perhaps a bit different in the newer ones. These first two verses especially are a little difficult because the Greek is somewhat ambiguous. Not the meaning. The meaning of the text is crystal clear, but some of the details make it a little harder to translate. It's why it comes across differently. So Jesus is, what is crystal clear here is that he is directing their faith in him, that he assures them he will come again. But in order to deal with the text, we need to consider some of these details. For instance, in verse 1, the words believe, as they are here in the ESV, believe in God, believe also in me, or even as the King James has it, you believe in God, believe also in me. These are translated as though they're imperative, but there is no imperative. They are indicative in the Greek. It's as though you believe in God, you believe in me. But what comes after that, the response that follows, implies an imperatival force. I think Jesus is there is the indication, there is the implication that he means it to be an imperative. Believe in me as you believe in God. The same type of confidence that you have in the Father, you are to have in me. We're to believe in God and to believe in his Son, Jesus Christ. But then verse 2 is a little difficult as well because, as we have it, if it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? The punctuation there that would indicate it's a question isn't there. But again, the way Jesus phrases it implies such a rhetorical question. Would I have told you this if it weren't true? He says he is going before them. They can't come with him now, but they will follow afterward. So Jesus is reassuring them of this. So this is the comfort that he offers for troubled hearts. That if you're believing God, then believe that he has revealed his plan and his purpose in his Son, Jesus Christ. That he has come to dwell with his people in the person of Christ. But his purpose is to dwell with you forever. To bring you, as David says in Psalm 23, to the house of the Lord. I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So he's come to dwell, but his purpose is to bring his people to his dwelling. And so we have Jesus saying, I'm going to prepare a place for you, and I will come again and take you to myself. This is where we have this in my Father's house. There are many rooms or mansions, as it is in the older translations. Literally, it's dwellings. We might think of it like a family whose son gets married and then an addition is built onto the house so that he and his family can live there. But the Father's house, if we think back in John 2, it was used in reference to the temple. My Father's house, Jesus said, is to be a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of thieves. Jesus is building the house. That's he's preparing the place. He is the temple building Son of God. Years ago, when we lived in North Carolina, it was a place I loved to visit that was not too far from our home. It was Wilson Creek Gorge. Wilson Creek begins at Grandfather Mountain, very small, but then it goes down and opens up into this large bottom. But on the way, some of you know where it is. So you're nodding your head. But on the way down, it's beautiful. There are boulders and rapids and steep mountain scenes on both sides. And as a boy who grew up in Florida, I had never seen anything like this. I was used to flat land and black water and cypress swamps. And so I had never seen such a beautiful scene. And I remember the first time I went, my thought, I'm sure I heard someone say this, I think it's also expressed in a song, but I thought, if the Lord has made all of this in the space of 6 days, what has he been working on for 2,000 years? I don't think that's quite the idea. That Jesus is overseeing this heavenly construction project, that he's got his hard hat on and his blueprints out and his tool belt, and that he's building a mansion for each of us. But he is building a house. Scripture tells us he is building a spiritual temple of living stones, that it is built upon the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, that he himself is the chief cornerstone. The Church of Christ, the new Zion, the new Jerusalem, it's the dwelling place of the Father. It's constructed by the temple-building Son of God to bring about this ultimate fulfillment of the promise. I will be their God, they will be my people, and I will dwell with them. So he comes to dwell in the person of his Son, but his purpose is to bring us to himself, that where I am, you may be also. That gets us to Thomas's objection and his question here. Lord, actually, we don't know where you're going. You tell us we know the way. We don't. We don't know where you're going, he says in verse 5. So how can we know the way? Thomas. What do we know him as? Doubting Thomas. I think of all the disciples, with what little we know about them, of course, there are those that we know virtually nothing about. Some of them, of course, are more prominent, like Peter, John. We hear of Andrew and Philip. We come to Thomas. Thomas, who was called the twin. Thomas that we know for his doubts. And I think of all the disciples, as far as what we know about them, that I myself, and I wonder if there are any like me, but I myself am most like Thomas. The doubter, the skeptic, the pessimist, the one who appears to be a realist. Here he appears to be a realist. Lord, we don't know the way. Following the resurrection, of course, he has his doubts. He said he wouldn't believe unless he could put his fingers into the wounds that Jesus received on the cross. Of course, Jesus appeared to him. Thomas, put your hand and reach here into my side. I don't think he ever did. He seems to drop to his knees right there. Oh, Lord, my Lord and my God, he confesses. But there's another occasion in John 11 where Thomas speaks up. So back when Jesus decides it's time to return from to Bethany, Lazarus has died, and so Jesus has been hiding from the Jews. Remember, he's withdrawn himself, but he goes back, and this is going to be the thing that really drives them over the edge, that really gets them to where this the conspiracy comes to a head. They know they have to do something about this man. His following he's gaining this following. We have to put an end to this. And Thomas realizes that Jesus is putting himself in jeopardy making himself available, exposing himself once again to the Jews. And so Thomas says in John 11, "Let us go with him that we may die also." So we might say Thomas is a realist, but I think his words here betray his belief that this can't possibly end well. Thomas is the doubter. He is the skeptic. He is the pessimist. The resurrection was too good to be true. I won't believe. No, Lord, I don't know the way. Let us go that we might die with him. In other words, if he's our hope, and if he's going to make himself accessible to the Jews who want to kill him, we might as well go and die with him so that all of our hopes die together. And I think that's me, the pessimist, the skeptic. Not that long ago, my wife remarked, I heard her say it over a couple of weeks or months to different people. The words she used, "We're in a good place right now," in reference to a number of things, circumstantially. The children and their education and social life and our own relationship and relationships with them. Our own stability as we reflect back on days working a full-time job and having another part-time job and going to seminary and trying to plant a church. Things seem a lot more stable than they did then. And we're thankful of where in a good place, meaning where things are with regard to Ortega. Seeing numerical growth, seeing spiritual growth. Thankful for a body of believers who, above any other thing that they're seeking in a church, is being committed to God's Word, faithfulness to Scripture. So I heard her say this a few times over the course of a few weeks or months, and she said it to me, and I replied to her somewhat jokingly, "You keep saying that. Now watch, something bad's going to happen." And it was as though, as soon as those words came out of my mouth, it was as though the Lord smote me in my heart. That's awful. Like Thomas's words, betrays a lack of trust in God. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. My mouth betrayed. My heart is full of a skeptical pessimism. No way this can last. It's too good to be true. Don't verbalize it. It's bound to end badly. Trouble's around the corner. It's an unthankful heart. It's a lack of faith in God. A lack of faith that He will either continue to bless, or if something bad does happen, that He will sustain us by His grace. And truly, it's a questioning of God's goodness. I think Thomas, what we know about him, was such a skeptical pessimist. And I wonder if you're like Thomas. Jesus had been telling them what he was about, what he was doing, where he was going. And Thomas says, "No, we actually don't know where you're going. How can we know the way?" And how does Jesus answer Thomas? The comfort that Jesus gives, the answer that Jesus gives, or the answer that he gives here, is akin to the comfort that he gave a little earlier. What he does is he takes Thomas and he redirects him where? Not to some map, but back to himself. You say you don't know the way, Thomas. You wonder about the way, about where I'm going, the way to the place that I'm preparing, the way to fullness of life and communion with God, the way to dwelling with Him forever, the way to the Father's house. Thomas, I am the way. Thomas, I am the truth. Thomas, I am the life. So he said, "Let not your hearts be troubled. believe in God. You believe in God. Believe also in me. He's redirected their troubled hearts to himself. And now for Thomas's questioning heart, he's redirected Thomas to himself again. Another Thomas, Thomas of the 14th and 15th centuries, Thomas a Kempis. Maybe you're familiar with this work, The Imitation of Christ. He said that without the way, there is no going. Without the truth, there is no knowing. Without the life, there is no living. So with our questions, with our troubles, as one pastor puts it, when we are troubled, where are we to go? It is, what is the way? Who can we trust? What is truth? What are we to do? That is to say, how are we to live? What we need as an answer to our questions, what Thomas and people like me with the skeptical pessimism need, the questions that arise in this way are from our troubled hearts. What we need is to be redirected to Christ. And that's what he does here. He redirects Thomas back to himself. All that the Old Testament promised, all that the hope that was forthcoming, it culminates in Jesus. And so in verse 7, we see that to know him is to know the Father. If you had known me, Thomas, you would have known my Father also. Because apart from him, there is no access to the Father. No one comes to the Father except through me. But then another disciple has a request, and that brings us to the second part of our passage, to Philip, verses 8 to 11. If you've been tracking with us through John's Gospel for some time, then no doubt you've picked up on this theme. It's a theme that we've heard this morning in the text that we see throughout chapter 14 and really throughout John's Gospel, but it's really concentrated in chapter 14. There are so many references to the Father here. Jesus, all of this time that we've been seeing his ministry in John's Gospel, now privately, but previously publicly, in what he said to the Jews, he told them that the Father bears witness to him, that he does the Father's works, that the Father works through him, that he does the Father's will, that the Father is pleased with him and what he does, that his goal is to glorify the Father, that he reveals the Father, that his sole purpose is that he was divinely sent for the sole purpose of doing the Father's will, speaking the Father's words, doing the Father's works. And we've heard this more than once, on repeat, again and again and again. It's been a continual beating of this drum. So Philip, it's a bit of a surprise, but also an understanding that he would ask such a question with regard to the Father. But then again, we wonder, how can you ask this question? He says in verse 8, Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough for us. Moses received a glimpse of glory hidden in the cleft of the rock, after all. Isaiah saw the glory of God fill the temple in the year King Uzziah died. If you've come to reveal the Father, then show him to us. Show him to us. It seems that's what Philip is asking. Something like that. Some sort of vision. Yes, you're right. We are troubled. Yes, we believe. But what would truly comfort us? What would truly assure us? What would really seal the deal? Just show us the Father. Let us get a glimpse of that glory. And that, he says, will suffice. That'll be enough for us. How many of us, though, haven't wanted something similar? Lord, could you just make it plain? Could you just give me a sign? Could you just show me? I don't think this is quite the same in the same category of the unbelief that we've seen from Jesus' opponents, who demand a sign from him, or we won't believe, or we won't believe unless we see a sign, or later as he's on the cross, who demand that if you truly are the Son of God, then come down from the cross. I think this is more akin to those questions we often ask for, the things that we often long for. Make it plain, O Lord, what direction should I go? Which option should I take? You and I both know the Lord doesn't operate in that way. Not typically. So Philip's request here is answered by Jesus with a gentle rebuke. Jesus corrects him. Philip, how long have I been with you? And you still don't understand. He says this, and you still don't know me, Philip? Of course, Philip did know the Lord. And yet there was more lacking. Isn't this true of our own discipleship? So much we've come to know about Christ, and there's still so much more we don't know. And sometimes what we don't know informs our questioning, informs where we are. It's sort of like as he brings them along. I love the picture in Mark's gospel. You see it where sometimes you wonder how they can be so thick-headed. We might ask the same question about ourselves, right? The blind man who's healed, he sees at first, remembers Jesus rubs the mud in his eyes. He sees the men, but it says trees walking. And then he does it again and he's able to see clearly. And it seems that this is a picture of what he's doing in his disciples. That they've come to understand he's the Christ, but there's so much more they don't understand yet. When he begins to speak about his death or going towards Jerusalem, no, you can't go there. You can't do that. Not knowing the way. Philip, or may Christ ask this of each of us, calling us by name, have I been with you so long and you still don't know me? You still are unfamiliar with my ways? Philip, have you seen me? You've seen the Father. What you're looking for, what you're longing for, the fullness of that is right in front of you. Don't you remember how often I've said, Philip, that I don't speak on my own authority. The words that I speak, the works that I do, they're not my own. They're my Father's. Do you believe, he says, or do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me. Notice he doesn't say, I am the Father. But I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. I think he's expounding here the same great truths that introduce this book in John's prologue, as we hear that the Word, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The eternal Son of God was in the beginning with God and was God, distinct from him, yet co-equal with him in power and in glory. The Father's Word, the Logos, the self-expression, His creating Word at the beginning. All things made through Him, not anything made without Him that was made. And also His redeeming agent, His redeeming Word, the Word made flesh. Although the Lord spoke throughout history, as we read in Hebrews 1, many different times in many different ways, in these last days, he's spoken to us through his Son. And it's as though these are, of course, lofty truths. They're difficult to get our minds around. It's as though in verse 11, he says, believe this, Philip, what I'm telling you. But it's like he's saying, if you can't get your mind around this, then believe on account of the works themselves. You've seen what you've heard what I've said. You're not following along, but believe on account of the works. You've seen me do. Let your belief be the faith that seeks understanding. So in the midst of their troubled and questioning hearts, Jesus was there to provide comfort and answers. And in all of it, it wasn't necessarily the responses that Thomas or Philip were looking for. We would surmise this wasn't quite the comfort, quite the answers they wanted. But it was true comfort. These were true answers from the one who is the truth, who is the way, who is the life. And like them, this is where we find true comfort. This is where we find true answers for what we are to believe, for the way we are to go, for where we find life. The answer is found in the one who is these things, who says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Who is exclusively the way, the truth, and the life. Jesus, the only way to the Father. And what he does with our questions and with our troubled hearts is the same thing that he did with these disciples. That is to say, he redirects us and our focus, and our attention back to himself. Back to where it ought to be. That faith is not something that's merely general or vague. It's not just, you know, I just kind of have this feeling that things are just going to be okay. Things are just going to work out. It's not that. Faith has an object. Believe in God. Believe also in me. That Christ, again, is worthy of the same kind of belief, the same kind of faith, the same kind of confidence that we have in God. Thomas, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. Philip, if you want to know the Father, to know what he's like, to be assured, then remember what I've shown you in word and in deed. If you're really looking for the Father, look to Jesus. If you want to know what God is like, look to Jesus. He is the revelation of the Father. I think we'll close with this. Verse 1 and verse 11 really bookend the section. We have verse 1 comforting these troubled hearts. He says, believe in me. And in verse 11 to Philip, believe me. To comfort our troubled hearts, to give answers to our questioning minds, Jesus redirects the attention to himself as the way, the truth, and the life.